And he's going to tell us about a quantum experiment he's performed. And questions if they may
Thanks very much. Well, to start with, let me just thank Anthony Valentini for inviting me here. And thank you all for coming. Also, I'd like to thank Mr. Who's the person who's basically funding this place? Mike.
Lazaridis,
that's right. Because obviously he's started something that's quite unique. Private funding of foundational research like this is extremely important. I have my own little research institute called IRONS, which is sort of a micro PI. And I understand how tough it is to get funding for that kind of work, so it's wonderful. And I also like to thank Karen, who's been very helpful. She's not here, but it's important to thank her. So to start with, let me just quickly go over the historic background of this. I'm sure everybody knows about complementarity and wave particle duality here. And but basically, this whole thing is embodied in this little caricature, which shows that you basically start with a particle-like emission and a particle-like detection. But in between, something fun is going on. And it's not quite clear as to what it is. Sometimes it's like waves, sometimes it's decoherent like particles, depending on the situation. And as you know, Einstein and Bohr and the Copenhagen School had a lot of discussions about this, very serious debates for over 30 years, that ultimately apparently led to Einstein's loss in that he could not prove a Bohr wrong, because Bohr every time would come back using Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, or even Einstein's own general relativity and the ET relationship, to show that actually complementarity works. So quickly, just a few interesting quotations. Well, that's not what I meant, but that's basically the dilemma. The self-identity of the photon. What is it? Is it a wave? Is it a particle? Are we even allowed to use that kind of language? And the reason I'm giving these quotations is because it's important to pin down exactly what is meant by complementarity and what people mean when they say it. So I'll just, you know, acknowledge the fact that this is such a hefty issue that people like Einstein, you know, basically thought about it for 50 years and really didn't get it at the end to a solution. So I do it with all the honor and reverence to everything that has passed in terms of the history of this. Also, it's important to quote Bohr himself into exactly what is meant by complementarity. So Bohr essentially believed in two things. One, that the use of classical language of Maxwell and Newton is an essential part of the description of experimental apparatus and our results. So he believed in that kind of language, that you should use that language to explain what you have. Secondly, he, in the context of the Ridgway experiments that I will go a little bit further into, as we all know, he basically says, we are presented with a choice of either tracing the path of the particle or observing the interference effects. We have to do with a typical example of how the complementary phenomena appear under mutually exclusive experimental arrangements. These are very important. Essentially, what he's saying is that you can either have interference or Ridgway information, essentially because these are mutually exclusive logical processes. That is to say, the reason Einstein was getting into a fight with Bohr was because he hated quantum mechanics so much that he wanted to show there is a logical inconsistency involved. And it was very important for Bohr, maybe not for Heisenberg as much, but especially for Bohr, to show that this new thing that they put together is really not logically inconsistent. It leads to logical inferences that cannot be ever found to be inconsistent. And so, again, to quote Richard Feynman, this is somewhat of a negative statement, which I don't think is very helpful in science in general. when you basically shoo people away from thinking in a certain way or on a particular topic by saying that, look, all the giants have thought about it, they couldn't do it, who are you to think about it and do it? So don't even bother, because you're going to end up, basically he said, you end up in a little alley, a blind alley from which no one has yet escaped. That kind of thought probably has hindered this kind of experiment for probably 60 years. And just to show how critical this issue of mutual exclusivity and logical consistency is, this is from John Wheeler, one of my heroes, who says basically for quantum theory to say in one breath through which it slid and then another through both, obviously for the same quantum, is logically inconsistent. So again, the theme is logical consistency of the arguments. And also, this is from Scully, again, to show that this stuff is still current, this language is still being used in different types of formats, obviously. And I'll show you that this Bohr's complementarity concept has been formalized in a way that you can actually quantify the relationship between, for example, the visibility of the interference and the restraint information P. And we'll get to that in a second. But what is a rich way experiment? It really started with Bohr, Einstein, Levin in 1927. They talked about this whole thing in terms of, well, Einstein basically said that I'm going to catch the photon acting in an inconsistent way, such that I would set up an interference apparatus like this, I would see the interference pattern, and I would have probably one of this. The original setup was a bit different, but one of this would be movable. So if the particle went through that, there would be a recoil, and this thing would jiggle. And you would know that it came from that particular slit. Obviously, this is a thought experiment, but conceivably can be done. So he said that what ended up happening is that I would see the photon in the interference pattern. So that would tell me that it's basically sampling both of the slits. But at the same time, I would be able to say that it only came from one of the slits. And that is a logical inconsistency, because with that observation, you've basically set two mutually exclusive logical inferences. One, it came through one pinhole. Again, the same exact thing at the same space-time event came through both pinholes. That cannot be allowed. At least that was a contention. And Bohr vehemently disagreed with that and tried to prove him wrong. Typically, the types of interferometers people have been using in the last few decades is the Mach-Zehnder type, which is still being, you know, all the time used. And there's a paper, 2001, about incoherence and so forth in Nature, using the same setup. Again, this is to show this is current topic. This is not something dead that you should forget about. This is something that's critical to the foundations of quantum mechanics. And there are a number of people who are, in my opinion, sort of going against the mainstream, but are the mavericks in terms of trying to bring it out the foundational issues that are important for us to understand why quantum mechanics is so peculiar in terms of the way it projects itself to the macroscopic world. And to the motor language that we have as human beings who happen to have macroscopic sizes. So the kind of apparatus that I think is best suitable for the kind of arguments that I'm going to present is the kind that Wheeler and Bartel suggested in 1971. Obviously, Wheeler suggested it for his so-called delay choice experiment, and probably a large number of you know about that experiment. But the very basis of that experiment is the complementarity of two different parameters. One is the interference pattern, and the other one is the restraint information. In that experiment, essentially what you have is you basically have a double slit experiment on the left side. The coherent light comes, go through the slits, and you have a choice of placing a photographic plate there to see the interference data. So you start accumulating the interference data, and you say, okay, perfect. I know these photons behave coherently, but I don't know where they came from. The betray information is missing there. Now you remove that thing, allow it to go through the lens, and you have the images, and those images give you the betray information, because there is a one-to-one relationship between the images and the slits. So Let's quickly look at the way Feynman treated this wave particle duality issue and the way he attacked it. This is crucial because, as you will see, since Bohr, up until probably about 10 years ago, everybody thought that the issue of complementarity was essentially entangled, essentially the same as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And so basically, in a sense, if I do a little Venn diagram, I would say up until 1991, everybody thought that the particle duality, the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and the principle of complementarity are all the same. They explain the same types of events, they explain the same set of conditions, and really this seesaw effect was the same. Something very crucial happened. So after this, I'll explain that. So Feynman treats it again in the same vein as our friend Bohr did, using the uncertainty principle. So he basically says, yeah, you can accumulate the interference pattern fine. This is obviously with electrons. You can do that with neutrons or any other quantum system, coherent quantum system. And you end up having this other interesting situation in which you would have a source, very strong source of photons behind the slits, and detector 1 or detector 2 upon scattering by the electron would give you the information as to which electron was going through which slit. And funny enough, if you do this, in fact, this experiment was done at MIT probably 3 or 4 years ago. And you show that for the electrons that you have the literary information, that is to say, you know which of the slits they came from, the distribution is a decoherent distribution like this. There is no fringe visible. There are no regions in space that the electrons sort of avoid as a dark fringe. And so, as I said, everybody thought it was all uncertainty principle. In fact, Heisenberg himself thought that, and fought with Bohr even to the point of tears, that it's really nothing more than this. However, something interesting happened in 1991. Scully, Englert, and Walter suggested that the origin of complementarity could be something other than the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. A very insightful experiment was suggested by them, in which you basically have the same setup. Obviously, it's a lot more complicated than this, but essentially, it's an interference setup in which you have, instead of electrons, very heavy elements, heavy atoms. And these heavy atoms, the Wittgenstein information is sort of tagged by changing the spin of the neutrons within the, that's to say, you basically mark them by the internal state of the atom. You don't jolt them with very strong photons so that they scatter all over the place. You just very subtly change and mark the spin state. So what happens is you end up having the interference pattern disappear after you do this process of marking. Interestingly, so there is really no momentum kick to these atoms that washes away, that is to say, sort of moves the atoms out of the trajectories that lead to interference pattern. There is nothing, none of that going on. It's simply the fact that the wave functions do not happen, they're orthogonal and they cannot interfere. And they end up producing basically a decoherent distribution. This experiment was in fact carried out in, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, 98, eight years ago. But, and that's, whoops, we went a bit too far. This thing is going. So anyways, that was an epiphany for me because it gave me the, it sort of separated all these three different things into this, that you have really a three set of different things going on. You've got the wave particle duality, you've got Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and you got principle of complementarity. And if that is the case, then you think about what is going on in each of these different ones. For example, the wave particle relationship is H no. That is just E is equal to H no. So essentially, photons are quantized. The electromagnetic field is quantized. You can see one click at a time, or Geiger clicks and so forth. at a time. And the related and the energy and everything, all and the momenta of these photons are essentially described by that quantized state in the Compton scattering and all the other experiments that show the point-like effects of these photons. You see that. So that's one set. The other set is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which is basically about the commutation relationships between momentum and position and energy and time and things like that, which is essentially inherent in the Fourier transform process of quantum formalism itself. It is essential to the mathematical embodiment of quantum mechanics. So that's sacrosanct. You can't touch that, that's for sure. This is obviously correct too, it's because it's been observed, and we do it all the time in quantum in single photon band conversion and so forth. However, principle of complementarity suddenly seems to be removed from these and can be attacked on its own. That is to say, as a philosophical question, as a question of language, is it true that every time that I see an interference pattern, I don't have the betray information, and vice versa. So, and there is a violation of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. I'm not saying that the quantization of the field is wrong. These are not the things I'm saying at this point. What I'm saying is there is a problem with the complementarity principle itself. And so this thing was picked up by new scientists. The experiment was done initially at my institute, IRIS. And then we duplicated it at Harvard University, where I was a research scholar. Just to make sure that everything is right and I'm just not crazy and making up data. And then new scientists picked it up, and it became a huge headache for me, to be honest, because it was mostly negative comments from many of our colleagues who were basically, I think, startled by the connotations it had. And I must say, I myself didn't feel very happy about the results. But I did it. Actually, I did the experiment in 2001. I didn't go public with it for another 2-3 years because I wanted to make sure that everything I did checked out and was correct. And just figure out what the thing was, is basically going on. So this thing was picked up by many other outlets. And you know, there's a relatively good article in Wikipedia on this. So quickly, what is Miller's delayed choice experiment? As we discussed, you have the photographic plate. You see the interference pattern accumulate there. Or you can remove it, allow it to go through the lens. And you have the images form. And those images have the betray information. And for some of you who are sort of hung up on this lens thing and the imaging process, there is another experiment that's equivalent to this that doesn't use a lens. And that's the one I've actually done. And there's a paper on that one as well here. And if you want your scientist copies, it's here as well. But basically, Wiener, using complementarity principle, uses the setup and says, you know what? If you see a photon here, you should say that it came from that particular pinhole. And therefore, the distribution could not possibly be a coherent distribution. You should rule out the possibility of a coherent state for the photon. You sort of project backwards in time. And he uses this sort of a gigantic story, makes it a much, much bigger thing. You end up having a galaxy producing gravitational lensing and all this stuff at very large scale events. In a sense, you as the observer determine what the path of the photon was. Depending on the type of measurement you want, you can have the lens, see the retrieve information, or you can just place the photographic plate, see the interference pattern. And that sort of didn't run with me very well. So, something's shaking. But, okay, so here is basically the data. This is from Harvard. So essentially, you have the images, and there are two mirrors that send the signal to two different CCDs. The reason for this, I mean, there's really no trick here. I mean, you can actually scan this thing with one CCD, or basically see what you have. You would have two very bright spots. The reason I did this was because I wanted to sort of distribute the light over a larger area, so I don't have any hot spots due to the depth of the contrast limitations of the CCD. So you can actually have it right there at the image plane. So as you see in this, the two images are essentially the same. Oops, this one keeps going on its own. Okay, so that's, okay, so the two are identical, in a sense. Nice little spots. Then the next step is, place a bunch of wires, thin wires, at the dark minima, at the dark fringes or the minima of the interference pattern you previously saw. And just to see what the effect of the wires would be if a decoherent situation is going on at the wires, we block one of this list to see how much light is scattered or absorbed by these wires. And you end up with something like that, which is clearly different from the previous one that you saw. Now the last portion, which is the actual crucial part, is this. You open both slits, have the wires placed at the minima, and see what happens to it. You basically get the same sort of data distribution of light and resolution as you got when there were actually no wires in the path of the light. This is very strange from the point of view of complementarity, because if this tells you where the photons are coming from, and therefore you should assume that they behave decoherently, they could not have interfered. And there is no reason why these wires should not block a certain portion of this light. However, it turns out they do not block much of the light, very, very insignificant amounts. And in fact, the difference between the amount they should block and the for the coherent and decoherent cases is about 80 times, depending on the thickness of the wires. So basically, you end up with a situation in which if complementarity was right, you would have this. However, we observe this, which is very close to the control where there is actually no wires whatsoever. A better view of this is a counterplot, in which you actually end up summing up the total amount of flux in each of these images and the distribution. So that's the control. That's where there is no wires. That is when one of the wires is one of the slits is closed, and that's sort of the decoherent result. And this is when you have both of the slits open and the wires present. So the flux, if you look at them, are fairly close in these two cases, but for the prediction of Copenhagen interpretation and principle of complementarity, it's a statistically significant difference between the control and the actual observation. This is the frontal view of the setup, which isn't very sophisticated. You can actually do it at any high school lab in terms of sophistication of experiments. It's very simple. And I don't know if this is important to show, but just for the kick of it, to see that in reality, how the dynamics of the experiment works, I'll sort of show you this little video. So this is, if it runs, okay. So this is basically, we are looking at the images, at the image plane. And just one CCD is seeing the whole thing. So one of the slits is closed, then both of them are opened. And the wire is placed at the central maximum. That is to say, so you have an interference pattern, you place it at the maximum of the interference pattern. So we see what happens. Essentially, as you open and close it, you end up having a change in this little line on the sides is the light that is scattered by the wire. This is the sort of reduction in the betray information, because of the scattering, the light that is coming from this particular pole is sort of seeping into the other image. And that is where the loss of information comes from. That's fine so far, complementarity holds. Now, so this is again the same one. If we go the next slide. So one is closed, both open. Okay, so we did that. Now, here, we have both open, and the wire is actually moving from the central minimum to the maximum. So we are looking at what this wire is actually doing in terms of the scattering of light, being at the minimum or being at the maximum. As you expect, because the wire is at the minimum, and it doesn't receive much flux, it cannot scatter anything. And so the images, are, as you can see, are pretty clean. However, as we move it up along the optical axis, perpendicular to the optical axis, and sort of cross the fringes, we start to see this band, which is again the scattering caused by the wires. And this is a real phenomenon. This is a real effect. It does make a huge difference where you place the wires. And if it's placed at a minimum, you still have the true nice images as though there was no wire present. But as you move farther up or down, sort of start receiving flux, you scatter around and you reduce the retrain information. And the last one is basically, again, both are open. And then one of them is closed, essentially, and the wire is at a central minimum. That is to say that, so we have the interference situation, we have the wires at the minimum, so the images are restored, but we want to see what happens if I close one of them. That is to say, as soon as I close one of them, I'm supposed to get scattered. This is another way of showing that it depends on the light, on the amount of flux that the wires receive. So again, both are open, one of them is going to be closed, wire at the minimum. And as you close one of them, you'll start to see that line appear. I hope you can see it. Can you see it? The scattering line? Yes or no? Okay. So it's faint because it's just one of the images are open, one of the holes are open. But it's there. So another way of doing this experiment is this one, which I did after I heard a lot of stories from a lot of colleagues who had a problem about what the lens was doing and the Fourier transform of the lens and the conservation laws applied to it and so forth. So here is another experiment, which is a bit more difficult to perform because of the sizes involved, but it can be done, and I did it, and it's relatively good data. So again, this is the same essential setup as Weir's delay choice experiment. You have a coherent source, but now this time the lens is behind the slits, and the idea is not to have imaging process going on, just to bring in two coherent light beams together, and then let them evolve unitarily into separate distributions so that they could be told where they're coming from. So forget those little dots for now. Remove those in your imagination. At plane sigma 2, if you have a photon viewed at one of the two detectors at this, the only conclusion you can make is that photon originated in this slit. Again, the reason for that is that usual simple wave particle duality issue, that this thing has a definite momentum. It came from that particular slit. As soon as I collapse the wave function, its momentum is known, and therefore I cannot attribute it to any other place. If I do, I end up basically having to violate the conservation of linear momentum by about delta p, which it is to say that the momentum that the photon as it went through one of the slits ended up changing its momentum mid-flight to end up in the wrong place, and it just doesn't happen. It's not allowed. So the way it's done is that you end up having, in this region, sigma 2, sigma 1, the interference pattern 4, because the two wave functions overlap, and farther downstream they get separated. And you place those tiny little wires. In my experiment, I just have one wire, which is on a mask. and you just place it at the minimum and move it along. This thing is really small, it's about half a millimeter across, and there are about 8 fringes within that. So it's a very small area, and the wire is of the thickness of 10 microns. So it's quite small. And so let's quickly go over the issue of quantitative definition of wave complementarity, of wave particle duality within the context of complementarity. People have been working on this issue for a while. Probably the first people who came up with this relationship were Wooters and Zurich, that basically showed through very convoluted arguments that there is a relationship between the visibility and the Richman information, or the reliability of the Richman information. That goes as this inequality, v squared plus k squared is less than 1 or equal to 1 at best circumstances. And so what is V? V is the visibility of the interference pattern, or the confess. That is to say, you look at the interference pattern, you look at the maximum, you get a number for the flux for the maximum at the bright fringe. You get a number for the flux at the minimum, or the dark fringe, of the interference pattern. And you plug it into this equation, which is a normalized, it's essentially confess. So you have I max minus I min over I max plus I min. And if you have a perfect interference pattern, V becomes 1, because essentially what happens is I min turns out to be 0. And you have an identity of I max over I max, which is over. And if you don't have interference, that is to say you have a decoherent distribution, there are no fringes present, you end up having V is equal to 0. K, which is a Richman information, is basically very similar to that. But then it says it's defined for each slip, for making sure, for example, that you have perfect information about photons coming from slip 1, you have K1, is equal to the amount of flux that you get from that slip when slip 2 is closed, minus the amount that you get when slip 1 is closed, which is this I1 minus I2 over the total of the flux. So if there's no overlap between the two, you have perfect Richman information. But if there is an overlap between the two distributions, you have less than one. Essentially, when you have sort of fuzzy image, both of the two images sort of overlap on top of each other, you can't tell which one of the photons is coming from what slit. Then you have K is equal to 0. And in just about every experiment that people have done, it has been shown that this relationship actually holds, that V squared plus K squared is always usually less than 1 or equal. So for my experiment, I chose the really extreme cases. I wanted to show that you have sharp interference and sharp Richman information, which is, if you have V and K, and you can demonstrate it in this graph, the relationship is on this little quadrant of a circle, and my cases are these two red extremes, where K is equal to 1, V is equal to 0, V is equal to 1, K is equal to 0. And that's essential because we don't want to do sort of in between cases where you have partial Richman information and partial interference visibility, because that is allowed by this inequality. However, if you could show that you have perfect Richman information, but not a visibility of 0 for your interference pattern, all of a sudden you violate this relationship. And that's exactly what happens in this experiment. So quickly, just going over this, I don't know if you'll see in the abstract, there is a link to a preprint. There's a 33-page paper that was published in Proceedings of SPI. Sort of talks about all the details of this. But there are very crucial elements in terms of the sort of technical issues that you have to make sure you've done right before you can talk about this thing. One of them is to understand that the conservation law applies to this. That is to say, if you have a decoherent distribution, the total norm is exactly the same as if you have an interference situation, a coherence distribution, the total number of photons within the two distributions is always the same. And you don't really have to do the usual norm that is from infinity to infinity when you take the integration. You can do it within the so-called area disk, which is the primary, the highest intensity of the. So let's just quickly look at this. If you have a slit or it's a pinhole, you if pinhole is the case in my experiment, you end up with a distribution which is like this. This is just diffraction. And it's a Bessel function, but this little area contains about 80%, 90% of the total irradiance or the total flux. And you can just pick this little area, which is called the area disk, and do whatever analysis you want to do. As you can, if you remember in the previous picture, I had a little thing here, which is called an aperture stop, which just selects this little bit, just the area disk. And it's essential to do that because you don't want to end up with having to deal with infinite integrations from infinity to plus minus infinity. You just want to do from S. From minus S to S within this little region. And again, quantum mechanics holds perfectly. All the relationships here hold for it. So this is solid gold. And I won't go through all the details of this, but this is a crucial step. And so the question is, how come nobody actually talked about this particular process? Why was it that when Bohr and Einstein discussed this issue, they missed the boat? Or in my opinion, they missed the boat. That there is a way of measuring sort of ensemble properties, like the interference step, that you can perform without really even collapsing the wave function. I'll get into that very quickly. So just remind ourselves, an interference pattern is an ensemble property. V essentially is an ensemble property. You cannot talk about the interference or coherence of a single photon. For example, here you can't really tell which one of the two distributions is really an interference step. You have these little clicks sort of randomly distributed. You can't say, there is not enough information to say where it's coming from. So I can't tell you this photon was coherent or not, or this one was coherent or not. But as I allow it to evolve in time, I start to see the ensemble, and here is obviously the coherent distribution, and there is the coherent distribution. Now, crucially, again, something very peculiar happens when you have an interference pattern. You have regions in space that the photons essentially avoid, the dark fringes. Now, what is so significant about that? If you are a quantum theorist, you don't really think about the nulls much. Nulls don't give you information. It's always when you have a click, when you have a little collapse of the wave function, and you say, OK, now I know the reduction state of the wave function, what it was. However, you can't actually know whether there is interference or not. And if you can't buy this argument, then there is really nothing to my work. This is the crux of the argument. You can have a detector placed at the dark fringe, as we discussed. And instead of placing it at the bright fringe, you have here a place where there is no flux. So as, like this, and this is actually the actual setup. So you have a little grid of the wires and the wave function. The interference pattern forms before the wires and after the wires. The wires are placed so well that the interference pattern is minimally affected. So doing a little theory, we can see that there is a huge difference between, so this is basically an interference pattern, and this is the coherent distribution. And that little asterisk is where the wire is placed. That thing would block, depending on its size, here is 1/10 of the peak-to-peak distance of the two bright fringes. The amount that it blocks is clearly a lot more when you have a decoherent distribution than when you have a coherent distribution. And furthermore, the thing is not affected, the distribution is not affected much if you have an interference pattern. Before and after the wire, you pretty much have the same distribution. However, That's not the same for the decoherent distribution. And this is another thing which is a bit more technical, but it's essentially to say that it is impossible to have diffraction or scattering by a wire for a wave function that has a null at that wire. So that's another very important issue. You can't scatter something if the amplitude of the wave function of that something is zero at your location. You can't scatter it. It's not allowed. And this can actually be rigorously proved. This is just a little demo, that if you have a wave function which is non-zero, hits the barrier, it's a Dirichlet boundary condition, hits the thing and sort of scatters all over the place, that's the kind of diffraction which shows what those lines that you saw later on, as it evolves unitarily, produce the reduction in the train information. However, as you can see, we've moved it farther down, and there is, to the extent to which this thing interacts directly, locally with the wire, to the same extent you see these little lobes, or the diffraction. And if it completely misses it, you have absolutely no effect by the wire on the wave function. So, this is my view, that the reason they sort of missed the boat was because they did not think about what I call contextual null measurement. And what is the meaning of that? The fact is, the null of a wave function can be verified non-perturbatively. This is crucial. You can actually measure the nulls. Know that you're nulling your wave function without killing the wave function or disturbing it or affecting it, reducing the norm or dephasing it or decoherent. These are important things. We usually think about any kind of measurement you make on the wave function, even if it's quantum non-convolution. You end up with messing up something in some quadrature, something that affects the wave function. However, you can know the nulls, sort of get global areas where there is no flux or there is no amplitude without collapsing the wave function. And how is that done? It is done in the following way. And this is in section 3 of the longer paper. That you can actually, if you have a wave function, left side, and forget about the left side, just look at this little circle, if that side, and after it passes the scatter or a wire, or whatever it is, the opaque piece of wire that's in its path, after it passes it, you have psi prime, if you denote them like that. What happens is, if you end up having the norm concern, that is to say that you basically have the same flux before and after, and you obviously have to do an ensemble measurement on this. You have to do it a large number of times to be able to make a statement like this. But once you do that, if you find out that the flux wasn't affected, the only possibly allowed scenario or situation for what is going on at the wire, allowed by quantum mechanics, is interference, destructive interference. You cannot have any other explanation for this. And that's something that you guys probably should challenge me on and start thinking about ways of going about this to prove me wrong. But that would be fantastic. I'd love to see it. If you can show that you can describe the fact that the norm doesn't change is not explained by interference, but some other process, that would be a discovery, in my opinion. And I doubt anybody can do it. So that's crucial. You can actually show there's interference. And so again, just quickly to recap, that was what we had. But this is sort of a discussion of the using Feynman's process, saw over the past, of what actually a lens is doing and so forth, which I don't think is essential for our discussion. But I'll quickly go over it. This is another view of those images that you saw. These are the profiles, probably it's easier to see that this is closer to the control than this. Okay. And if anybody has does anybody have a problem with the lens as a Ritchie information provider? Okay, good. All right. So, go ahead.
Well, Okay, so when you started by describing this analogous experiment, one version of Wheeler's delayed choice experiment, where so they have this setup where so you have these two slits and there's the lens, and the lens focuses the image of the top slit downwards,
right,
the image of the bottom slit upwards. Now, it is true that in the literature, people tend to say, well, if the photon is in this top image, then it came from this bottom slit.
Uh-huh.
Right? That's a very common assumption, and you know, you're making the same assumption in what you're doing. And I think that's sort of fair enough, in a way. But one can query that. I would say that two counts.
I think one should query that.
Right. I think one point is that it's a sort of language that, well, the photon that landed here came from this slit. That's a sort of semi-classical hand-waving thing. I mean, there's nothing strictly in quantum theory that contains the notion that the photon came from here. And secondly, there is at least one formulation of quantum theory, the Breuer-Bohm, which gives the same empirical results for anything that you're going to see at the backstop. But where, in fact, when these two waves...
It's the opposite.
The actual photon, I mean, it's sort of crazy trajectories, if
that's
you like,
right, yeah.
Contrary to what you'd expect.
Right.
Sort of semi-classically. But it's saying, oh, the photon that came down here actually came from the bottom slit.
Sure.
But everything you see in the backstop is the same. So...
But if I may, in that version of it, again, although the thing is reversed, but the one-to-one relationship between a slit and an image
that's
is still pop-up.
That's true.
So it's not reversed, but it's still there.
That's true.
And that's the crucial part, that you sort of assign, you can assign that's where it's coming from.
Oh, that's fair enough. But I mean, I suppose the point I want to say is that this notion of, well, of which way information here, seems to me something that is strictly, it's something that most people tend to say, but strictly speaking, it's actually beyond what quantum formalism itself is really saying.
I sort of tend to agree with you.
But that doesn't mean the experiment is not interesting.
Sure.
But maybe one
sure.
of the better
so sense he's looking at the principle of complementarity anyway,
right.
Where exactly that language is used.
Or exactly that kind
that
of
That is the language that is being used.
That's okay. I mean,
that is right.
At least it's not the conformism, but
that is right.
It's vaguely.
Right.
Right. I mean, when you think about the experiment in which the lens is not used, so there is really no lens there, and the only argument you have is a conservation law of linear momentum, it seems to me very difficult to sort of slip out of it somehow and say, okay, this photon that I saw, well, I can't really talk about where it came from. But once I collapse it, I know it has a definite momentum. And it could not have come from somewhere else. And so, I'm conflicted as to how this language should be even modified or even this whole thing described. Because if you insist on saying that it came from that pinhole, then obviously you can't talk about interference. But the problem is, the funny thing is, before this experiment, you could talk about that. In fact, I talked to Bob Griffiths. I think he was one of the presenters here. His, you know, consistent histories stuff, Gell-Mann and his colleagues on me, they talked about the decoherent histories. You can't have a decoherent history, this explanation of the delay choice experiment, if you don't have those wires sitting there telling you, I didn't see any photons. You can actually say, yeah, it came from that pinhole, and that's safe. Why? Because you're not really observing at the plane of the interference. And you can't tell what's happening. But once you have those wires as your silent witnesses to ask you what's going on, all of a sudden you can make a statement. Although you're not collapsing the wave function, you're not seeing your photon, by the act of not seeing your photon, you're making a statement. So, I agree. I think either we have to give up the common mode of language that we're used to, in terms of, you know, I'm saying it came from there or it came from there. That's our usual macroscopic role. Or we have to, which I'm sort of, again, I'm conflicted about this. I don't like to give that up because that's how I think. That's how I explain, even in quantum mechanics. When you talk about wave functions, I talk about this wave function came from this pinhole. The amplitudes, I can actually write them exactly as though it started from that point. And I don't end up with any problems within the formalism of quantum mechanics itself. But when it comes to measurement, when it comes to that little monster of projection, that you actually reduce this state to something definite, then the conflict begins. Because let's forget for a second the measurement process. Let's think about it as a wave phenomenon. Just an ordinary electromagnetic wave. There is really no conflict between the Bajrayan formation and interference. Because in one plane, you definitely have the superposition of the two fields. And as they evolve, they go to their separate ways. And however, at the detector, so if I can, so I'm not really sure where this is going in terms of the implications. It has some applications that I'll show later on. But one of the things that I'm a bit confused about is this, this collapse issue. Because, as I said, you can talk about waves, and you could have waves doing all this stuff, going through both slits, overlapping here, producing interference, going in their little separate detectors, and inducing whatever detection process that's going on there. But you can do this with single photons, and for some reason, although both of these wave functions are important here, equally important to produce interference, for some reason, just one of the two collapses. One of the two registers the product. And it's a random process. We don't know which is which and how. So something mysterious is going on. Or we are just crazy. We just shouldn't use the language that you're using in our day-to-day lives. Because if I insist in using that, I'm saying I had a physical phenomenon which depended on both of these equally. However, here, it's only one of them that matters. And why? So if you look at the work that has been done on semi-classical quantum mechanics and so forth by Wollaston and to some extent by Stolle, you see that you can actually produce effects like that assuming the perfectly classical electromagnetic field. You can do that. You can actually have sort of localized detection process, which happens to be anti-coincidental. That is to say, only one of the detectors clicks. And the reason for that is they argue that you have your detector is quantized. It's not the field itself. It's the detector that's quantized. And because of the thermodynamic states that are not always the same at the micro level, it just happens to be that one of those trigger detectors happens to be ready to detect, and it just clicks. Fine. But I mean, for a while, I thought that was a nice way of explaining it. But all of a sudden, you think about parametric damper regime and two photon states, that you really have two photons that, after you have your damper converter, you end up with these two little beams. And you know for sure if this guy clicks, the other one is going to click. You know that. So you can't use this argument of, the simple argument that, well, the field is present in both, but here the thermodynamic state is such that this clicks. But how come here the thermodynamic state is not different? Why is it, what is peculiar about these two that they produce coincidental clicks, but here you don't get that? Obviously, you have a two photon state here and you have a single photon state there. That's for sure. But why? What is so special about these wave functions? And so I have some other experiments that I have dreamt up and we are sort of working on that attempts to answer that question. But I think from a theoretical point of view, it is important to think about just purely about the contextual no measurement process itself and formalize that a little bit and see what comes out of that. Because interesting things can happen. For example, one of the interesting things is that using this process, you can tell whether there is a beam of light in a specific region of space. So let's think about it for a second. Say there is a laser beam coming from that to there through here. I can't tell if it's there until I put my hand in front of it or put a detector that is, say, reduced the norm somehow. I collapse some of the wave function. I have to do something. Put a little beam splitter, you know, get some reflection off of it. Then I would know there is something. However, with this process, you can actually tell if there is a beam without reducing it or affecting it. It's sort of an interaction-free measurement of the signal. And this is how you can do it. So obviously, this is very difficult. So I don't think it's going to be a feasible thing that everybody's going to jump on from telecommunication. That's not going to happen. But theoretically, it's interesting. Because you can have a signal beam, and again, this is conceptual, but it can actually be done, which has these zeros and ones, turns off and on, and it's a coherent beam. And you have a mutually coherent beam to that one, which is always on. So I call this the interrogator beam. What happens is, so I have these two different detectors. One of them looks at my interrogator beam, and the other one is the actual signal. And this thing doesn't have to be detected. You can remove that detector, allow it to go through its thing. So I'm sort of trying to eavesdrop on this little signal to see if it's there and what it's saying. So my little interrogator beam is present. When both of them are one, my interrogator beam is 100%. I see the whole thing going through. When that guy is zero, my interrogator beam suffers a reduction. I get like 96% or something. There's a reduction in that. So that's a zero in my signal. Now, the signal hasn't suffered any reduction in its norm. Why? Because if it's zero, it's zero. But when it's one, the whole thing goes through. And suddenly, I can do really weird things. I can copy a signal without removing any photons from it. Another very important issue is this cannot be done at the single photon level. You cannot do it. You've got to have a large number of photons per ones. That is to say, at least you've got to have enough to make a statistical difference in terms of the flux change for the interrogator beam. So if this thing blocks about 10%, you've got to have at least 10 photons per signal that one of them goes off and you would say, okay, now I know this thing, the other beam didn't exist. So these are interesting things which I think need to be eked out in a bit more formal way to find out exactly what it implies in terms of the measurement theory. But I think it's a significant concept that has been ignored so far. And all of it is probably because of the psychological milieu that we are in and the peer pressure and the way we think about the processes. Because to be honest, if you look at the history, Einstein won his Nobel Prize because of this photon picture, the particle thing. He didn't want to push the idea of the waves too far. Had he done it, he could have been able to think about these nulls and sort of bring it out in the same way to Bohr. And Bohr, respecting Einstein's Nobel Prize, didn't dare question the particle aspect, so he just kept on his views of things. And again, everybody was sort of obsessed with this collapse issue and the interesting magical qualities of this thing, which I don't think helps science much. Then you start talking about magical phenomena. It may be interesting for sort of public relations and things in science fiction, but in reality, science is not about that. Science is about bringing out exactly what we have. And I think my personal favorite as to what we should do is the investigation of the wave function collapse process. Exactly what is happening at the detectors up here that makes that little difference between one being detected and not the other one not being detected. Physics being an experimental field, essentially. But I think we should also do more theoretical expansion on this idea of contextual mode measurement. And with that, I finish my talk. Thanks so much for having your attention and listening to me. Yes.
So, none of the things you saw in the experiment actually violates the standard map mass components of quantum theory. It's all completely.
It's absolutely within the context.
So your issue is rather whether this sort of wording formulation of principal complementarity is correct. That's the thing that you're looking to address.
Absolutely.
With this experiment. At one point, you actually gave this equation, v squared plus k squared.
Yes.
And you said that you were experiment violates that. I didn't see the numbers.
Oh, yeah. I didn't go. It's in the paper. So, and there is another paper here. It's a shorter paper, sort of has more numbers in it. But basically, what is going on is that, so let's think about the experiment. So, because we have the images and the resolution of the images preserved, the Wijkman information is 1. Because we can actually calculate what is the probability of a photon going to the long slit. And this needs a little probably theory. So let's do that quickly. So the idea of.
So now you're looking at K.
Yes, we're going to talk about K. But before we do that, let me just quickly say something about the idea of the scattering by that scatter. So essentially what's happening, this is your wire, right? And so the wave function comes and goes through it and goes to the other side. So the part that survives to the right-hand side is what we see in the images. Now, I can write this formally in terms of what happens. So if I close one of the slits, I definitely have one of the images. So that one is closed. This image would be there. But I also have a bit of a leak to the other one. That's a reduction in K. That's a reduction in K. Okay? We want to show that that's not the case when we have both of the slits open. But we will see how that happens. So, but what is this coming from? This comes from the scattered portion of psi. So I can write psi prime as psi, so let's call it not as psi 1 because it's just one of the slits. So let's call it, so it's basically psi 1 incident plus psi 1 scattered, which is which survives, and the progeny goes on that side, which we see
okay,
on the other.
So I can see that when you have both slits open, the scattering goes away. But
okay.
What is this this stage? So if you want to interpret, so you want to say that if the photon, if this detector flicks up here, that means it came from the bottom slit, and vice versa. And the extent to which you can say that's true is a measure. The case is a measure of the extent to which that
right,
is
right.
true. That's what you want to say. But of course, the fact that this is scattering means that this measurement isn't a perfect measurement of which the thing came through.
Well, it only scatters when one of these slits is
open. But it's the fact that it's the consideration of what happens when one slit is open that justifies interpreting this as a measurement of which slit.
Not always. These are two different experiments.
I mean, usually in quantum theory, where you justify just abstractly,
right?
You say, well, I know this is a measurement of a certain projector because were the state prepared in an eigenstate, corresponding to that projector, I would get probability 1. Okay, so in this case, the justification is, you know, were only state 1 open, then I can be certain that the bottom detector.
Yeah,
but that's actually not quite true.
But, well, it is true, because as you said, you just quickly went over that, but look at this. If one of them is closed, my observable is this thing squared. The scattering is important. The K is reduced, because it becomes an observable. Give me an observable. But when both of them are open, So I have to sum all of this and then square it. No, these two are out of phase at that point. That is to say, the scattered portion does not produce any observables. You only end up, essentially, with, again, the psi 1 plus psi 2 squared, as though there was no scattering. That is a crucial point. If you don't agree with that, then the whole argument is wrong.
I take it from the point of view, I could say the following. I could say, well, I have a certain wave function up slits. Okay. Let's consider a general wave function just there. And now I can say, I can place these two vectors over there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I can say, what measurement operator, in more general language, what positive operator does these detectors correspond to?
Okay.
Do they correspond to an actual projection onto the thing going through this slit? Or something slightly different? And it looks to me like it's slightly different than slightly.
Well, the slight difference, that's good, because these two are not exactly out of phase all the time. This thing has a finite width, has a finite thickness. So as you span it, so let's think about that. This is my huge wire thing. At the middle of this thing, they're exactly pi out of phase. But as I go to the sides, that difference is about pi minus epsilon, pi plus epsilon. And that epsilon depends on the thickness. This little difference leads to leakage. But this leakage is a hell of a lot huger when you have a decoherent distribution than the case in which is essentially just this squared plus this squared.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that when you have, when you write down the operator corresponding to a measurement, okay, that should be independent of the preparation of your state. I mean, the operator corresponding to a measurement is something that doesn't care about the preparation.
Sure.
So I don't care about whether you've got one state or both states. I just want to know what the operator is. And that operator isn't quite telling you which part.
Depending on the setup, you can have a unitary evolution, you basically have a unitary evolution when you have no lens in the other setup, which is simpler to talk about. You have a unitary evolution. You have nothing peculiar or strange going on. You have just wave functions moving, and they spread through space. And when they overlap, they interfere as they should, as they move forward down the stream. Because there is no spatial overlap, there is no spatial interference. Obviously, there is interference in the momentum space, but that's a completely different story. We're not looking at that. We're looking at the spatial distribution.
Okay, so in any case, I'm not accepting this, but let's see how that works. This particular formula there, which you said was first derived by Wieters and
Zurich. And then Engler and Greengrad, yes.
You're saying that's a sort of mathematical formulation of the critical complementarity.
Right.
But presumably, that formula is derived under certain assumptions about what kind of situation you're looking at.
Sure.
It's something which follows from the standard quantum formalism in certain situations. So,
sure.
So if you're right about things, which I'm not completely convinced, then presumably the situation you're considering is not the kind of situation that we deserve.
Well, usually what they talk about, the funny thing is, in my experiment, so at each of these planes, you have those equations completely vilified, that they are correct. So in sigma 1, V is equal to 1, K is equal to 0. That's for sure. At sigma 2, K is equal to 1, V is equal to 0. That's for sure. The question is whether it's legitimate to mix these two and say, if my k is 1 here and my v is 1 here, therefore v plus k, v squared plus k squared is bigger than 1. And I would contend that is reasonable. And the reason for that is the following. Because the actual gets back to the logical consistency argument. The actual meaning of these things about v squared and k squared and so forth is really to say that I can make a statement about what happened at this stage. And if my V here tells me that it came through both slits, so it's referring to the same event here. Now, this thing is also referring to the same event there. And it's also, furthermore, importantly, it's for the same photon. It's for the same quantum that passed through this region and ended up here. So I end up saying, yes, in some region of the apparatus, it came through both pinholes. But as it went farther along, it turned out to go through just one of the pinholes. And so I think it's legitimate to use the V here and K here and V here and K here to combine them to show that, no, you can't do that. Because if you sort of project backwards in time to this event, you end up with these kind of logical inconsistencies, saying that it sampled both, but it didn't sample both, and all that. So I think one way out of it would be to say, let's not worry about what this V and K really talks about logically, you know, this logical consistency argument, just that it works. Like the rest of the quantum mechanics, it just works, and you have to accept it. Fine. I mean, in that case, I would say, okay, yeah, V is equal to 0, K is equal to 1. The relationship works perfectly in this plane. The relationship works perfectly, but it's for the same photon. But because it's for the same photon, I'm conflicted. But if you don't worry about the fact that it's because of the same photon, then the relationship holds. So it's sort of a...
Can I make a digression from this experiment?
Oh, absolutely, sure.
Take a spin measurement, spin 1/2. Imagine you have prepared a superposition of spin x up and down so that you have a spin z up. Now you measure spin x and you get an up result. Would you say still that the spin x was up initially or the polynomial?
Well, I would actually, if you read the paper, I do not like to talk about internal states. Because internal states is a whole different ballgame. And the arguments that are used there are not the same arguments that are used here. Here, the arguments for justification of Lichtwey information, for example, is the conservation laws. There, it's a different type of story. So you can have another problem with that is, you know, as you said, I can assume that I have a spirit airlock system that sort of separates my beam up there, you know, whatever state you want to have, SX up, SZ up, down. Now, here it's a superposition of the two, back before the spirit airlock. Fine. But that superposition doesn't give me any observables in terms of equivalent to the dark fringes. I don't have something that I can talk about as a measurement. So because complementarity is about measurement, I've got to have complementary measurement, at least operators, that do not commute, in a sense. So if I could have that, then I would talk about it. But I don't have an equivalent of the dark fringe situation for this spin. So that's why I sort of shy away from talking about spins, because it seems to me that it's an entirely different ballgame. And it's, in a sense, similar to the stuff that Scully suggested with the interference apparatus they talked about. So, yes?
I could imagine now that there's experiments with spin for that one, but never mind now.
Sure.
Perhaps one or two historical remarks. One is Heisenberg made a remark, a comment in 1930 on that sort of experiment where he, well, if I applied the remark to this experiment, I would say he was saying that...
Which experiment?
That on
the
yeah. He didn't refer to that specifically, but
sure.
The sort of situation was that it was, he said something to the extent it's a matter of taste whether you conclude from finding the particle in detector one whether it had originated from slit one.
Yeah, that's in the book, that's right, yes.
So that's one thing. The other is, I don't think it's quite fair to say Bohr was too respectful of Einstein's Nobel Prize. He did actually hesitate very long to accept the photon picture.
Oh, sure, that's true. That's true. But after he did, he sort of accepted it. He collapses over it, but. Yes.
So You mentioned consistent history at one point, and it seems to me that if consistent histories is the best candidate for how to make sense of complementarity language. Some people think this is, you know, sort of the need.
Well, that's your opinion.
But suppose you take that point of view. Then I think this experiment does not show that complementarity principle is wrong. So suppose you understand the complementarity principle as follows. What it says is that there is no consistent history wherein I can assign a projector to the system at the plane of the slits corresponding to passing through slit one or passing through slit two, and I can assign a projector to the particle at the plane with your wires wherein, you know, it actually has the interference pattern. And so you could say that's one way of cashing out the notion of complementarity. And as you admitted yourself, that if you have the wires in place, then there isn't a consistent history that has the particle passing through one of the two slits.
But that's ignoring the later measurement at the image plane.
Right, but I mean, we can still just ask this question as I asked it.
Oh, no, sure.
Is there a consistent history having those two projectors in it? And the answer is no. So if you cache that notion of complementarity in that
But you're ignoring the whole. You see, you have to take into account the whole experimental setup. What you're talking about here is basically just the interference portion. That's fine. In the interference portion of it, I can have the interference, and I have these wires, and here I have interference. Fine. And I could talk about interference all I want. And there is a consistent history with that. There is no problem. I could say it came through both pinholes. The problem arises when I take into consideration the later measurement, which I have to, because it's the same photon. It's the same wave function that ends up there. And so, I mean, to be frank with you, I talked about this with Giant, Griffith, about this particular issue. And he immediately said that the coherent portion of the discussion is completely off. You have to think about it as a coherent history. So if I think of it as a coherent history, there is no inconsistency. The only inconsistency is, why is it that this guy collapses and that one doesn't?
The only coherent history is true that at the final plane, you can say it was one there or at the bottom. But at the initial plane, the only coherent history has to have it in a coherent superposition of passing through both slits.
Right.
OK, so that I would say that if you're a neo-Copenhagenist, then you'd say that's what I mean by the principle of complementarity, that there are no consistent histories wherein, at that initial plane, it's bound to pass through one of the slits. And at the middle plane, it's bound to be an interference pattern. So all I'm saying is that if you cash out the notion of complementarity in that way, the way the consistent historians would, then this isn't a negation of it.
I'd like to see that formalized. I highly doubt that you can actually eke out of this that easily, because you're going to end up making logically inconsistent statements. Unless you ignore the part of the measurement process. That is to say, you only look at this and not talk about that.
So the relevance of that stuff, I would say, is that if you don't have the wires in place, mm-hmm. then you can make an inference. When I find it at the top, it must have come from the bottom. Had I done a measurement here, I would have found it at the bottom.
Right.
In a consistent histories framework, you don't even ask to do a measurement. You say, there is a consistent history when the wires are not present, such that, you know, when I find it up here, it was down there, but there's a projector I can assign to it.
But then you have
the fact that it makes those inferences when the wires are not present does not carry over to making those inferences when the wires are present.
Well, you have to work it out, and you would see that they do have to carry over, because the only reason why they shouldn't is the wires are scattering stuff. And if the wires cannot scatter, if the amplitude happens to be zero, you cannot talk about that, because they do not have an effect on the evolution of the wave function. I mean, that is to say, the effect on the evolution of the wave function is minimal compared to the case in which you have a decoherent situation.
I disagree with that. I think, for instance, if you consider the time reversal experiment, where you start off knowing that it's in one of the slits, and you consider the propagation backwards in time, and you ask what's the backward evolved Schrodinger equation in the case where the wires are present before where the wires are not present, you'll find very different evolutions. They do influence those backward propagating wave functions.
Well, you can't do that. You have to assume mutual coherence for the two when you start here. You can't, you know, if you're going to do it backwards, you have to say, although these two are separate spatially, they're mutually coherent. that is say they produce interference. So when you go backwards, it's essentially just turning the movie backwards. I mean, there's nothing else. You still have interference there.
But I'm imagining the backward evolution when you start with the particle known to be at the top, which is appropriate, I think, given that you...
With the top half at the detector? When you're talking about reverse, they have to start here.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I start here.
It's not coherent. So you start there. You evolve backwards.
Okay.
And let's say you solve it when the wires are not present. And then
you're ignoring this state function.
Well, I'm post-selecting on a case where I say find it in the top. And I'm asking, now let's back.
Well, that's the problem. You can't do that. You can't say just because I saw this here, there's no wave function here. Because if you do, you'll end up with exactly what you're saying.
So mathematically, you can say that. Just consider the wave function there.
There, yes. You would have scattering and everything. Sure, it wouldn't work. But that's not a legitimate thing to do. Because
mathematically, it's different. Mathematically, it's perfectly okay.
Mathematically, everything is legitimate. But the question is, what is the reality of the experiment? The reality of the experiment is that when you do the forward has both wave functions in both places. You want to do it backwards, you have to take both of them into consideration.
So let me try to rephrase. Here's the mathematical fact that I want to appeal to you. We can discuss its interpretation later. So I claim the mathematical fact that if you start with a wave function localized at the top, at the end, propagate backwards in time, what you will find for the wave function at the initial plane will depend on whether the wires are present or not.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sure.
So that's the mathematical fact.
In exact same way that you would if you close one of these slits.
Good. So now the inference I want to draw from that is that difference between whether the wires are present or not in the backward evolution is actually what's relevant to deciding whether you can make inferences from finding it here to it being down here as opposed to being up here. It's that that's critical because you're actually making a retrodiction. You're trying to say, I found it up here, therefore it was down here originally. So you have to ask whether the wires are important in the propagation of wave function doctrine in time. And the mathematical fact is that they are.
Again, no, because you're looking at two different situations. You're looking at the case in which one of the slits is closed or only one of the wave functions is considered. You're basically saying that you can only talk about sort of which way information if you only have one wave function and not both, essentially taking out the possibility of interference ad hoc. But that's not the case. When you have interference conditions like this, both wave functions are present. And then, let's put it this way. If I didn't have the wire there, I see the photon there, using your line of argument, I should not even talk about there having an interference present there. And I would be safe to do that, because there is no way for me to check whether there was an interference pattern there or not. So essentially, I understand your argument perfectly well, that it's not legitimate to talk about between information when both of them are open, because the best way to do it is close one, forward or back. It doesn't even matter forward or backward propagation. That's not the crux. The crux is whether one of the two slits is open or closed and what the difference is. My contention is you cannot basically use the same argument of reduction of between information when only one of them is open and apply it to the same condition when both are open. And perhaps you're sort of talking across each other, but I hope you get my point that you can't talk about, I mean, let's put it this way. What would you say if I have the situation, there are no wires there, and I see the photon? What would you say about that? What would you see in terms of the photon's origin?
In that case, we could infer that from the top slit.
You could infer. And the reason you can infer is that you can ignore that guy. You can ignore the other wave function because its presence is irrelevant to what you observe. It doesn't make a difference at all. Even if then you actually evolve the wave function, then mathematically, you have both of those wave functions, and they keep kind of mutually coherent state up until that point of the collapse, and then the other guy disappears completely. But when you treat this quantum mechanically, you don't close one of the slits when you're doing the analysis. You have both of the wave functions present, and they evolve through the system, and they overlap, they interfere, they go their own ways, and I just happen to see it there. So I don't think it's legitimate to talk about sort of essentially this is decoherent history. Why? You can't have two decoherent histories summed up to give you this. It's not going to happen. Two decoherent histories cannot produce interference. But I'm at a loss as to what to say in terms of the place the photon came from. when I have a situation like this. Let's put it this way. If I want to say that, okay, the wishful information is not reliable, the wires there actually do something, right? What do they do? What is it that the wires are doing that my photon suddenly is not reliably related to the original slit? And magic is not the word I'm looking for. I want to see a mathematical process within quantum mechanics that tells this is what the wire is doing. And, you know, magic words like entanglement and the non-locality and stuff like that.
So your point is that when you put the wires in place, in the case where both slits are open, you can show mathematically that it has no effect on the wave function because they don't, the nodes are there. And therefore you're saying, in that situation, it's okay to interpret the things having come from that because there was no effect anyway, so it should be the same as if the wire wasn't there.
Right, and if not, why not?
So I think it doesn't fit into the language of the system is different. And I think your argument is, I think your argument is difficult to put into the language of the system.
It doesn't fit.
It's intriguing, it's not the same maybe.
It's not the same.
Well, I think the particular problem he's pointing to isn't the problem of consistent history. It's a specific situation. I mean, he doesn't have to. You know, if he puts into language of consistent history, I think you're right that the problem isn't there.
So I just wanted to point out something interesting. I mean, I've been. That was translated to the Fifth Solvay Conference. I don't know if you've read the proceedings that are published in French, but there's something interesting that's maybe connected. I mean, you've talked about sort of conservation laws are playing a role in motivating this idea that well, from technology came from up there. And there's a sort of, well, I don't know how much, but sort of implicit idea that while the trajectory is, well, okay, to do with the conservation laws, that you think in free space, these photons are sort of moving in straight lines if you have an image of the movement. Okay, so the Fifth Solvay Congress, there was a discussion about Breuer's theory, and Brillouin was giving an example of how it explains interference effects. You get this funny trajectory and so on. And at one point, he says something like, well, you might think that, look, the trajectory of a photon in free space has to be in a straight line. Here's why that can't be. And he gives an example. It's a paradox, sort of paradox, that was hooked up by someone called Lewis in 1924. So what he has is the following. So he has a source of light here. And he has a mirror here, and the light hits the mirror, and then it goes on to a wall.
Right.
Now what he has, he just considers just the ends of the mirror. I mean, imagine that only the ends of the mirror can reflect. I'm not sure if I remember the details perfectly, but it's something like this. He has it set up so that if you draw rays from the source of light that go in a straight line, hit the mirror, and then hit the screen, that you can have a situation where rays that hit this end of the mirror end up at a dark fringe. And rays that hit the top of the mirror end up at a bright fringe.
Well, there is an interference?
There's an interference
because of the
on
two
the screen between the two
pieces that are
coming from there. Now, and then there's this reasoning. It says, well, a photon that lands at the bright fringe must have hit the top of the mirror. Okay. And there are no photons at the dark fringe. So you come to this conclusion that, well, the photons are only hitting one end of the mirror, so it should start to rotate, right? And this was Lewis's paradox.
Using the conservation law.
Conservation, right. So I'm just reminded of this, and I don't know what you'd make of this, but...
It sort of anticipates this,
right,
in a sense.
Right. But you could say that you know, it's a which way, looking at whether it's at a bright fringe or a dark fringe is a which way measurement. And
right.
Then, you know, you would say, well, if they hit here, and why doesn't it rotate?
Right. Anyway, right. That's exactly the point that actually Bohr and Heisenberg, they talked about this at length, that the conditions of interference preclude a space-time description in terms of the trajectory for the photon. So you either, so you end up in a complementarity. Being able to define things as in terms of trajectories or have interferences. And you're not going to have both. So you're safe. If you can show a condition in which both of them happen, you're in trouble. But if you can't come up with a way in which both of them are mutually present, that argument holds, because for some reason nature is designed that you can only see the trajectories or infer the trajectories and only see the.
But what is happening in this example and in your one? Is that if you make simply the assumption that while in free space the motion is in a straight line, then that is enough to arrive at something which is peculiar, and either the ordering or here is the conclusion
right.
Well, it looks as if the mirror should have changed. So, I don't know how, I mean, different people may conclude different things, but one conclusion. Well, it actually was Brillouin's conclusion was that, look, this idea of photons in free space in an interference experiment, that they move in straight lines, must be wrong.
And it certainly is wrong.
This is an argument in favor of De Broglie's theory.
The particle, right. Right.
Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that.
Right, sure.
As far as I understand, you are not attacking the formulas of quantum theory and just the complementary principle.
Yes.
If you're right, that is not a great loss that we use in complementary principles, in my opinion. But then you have...
It may be a great loss for logic. But maybe not for formals.
Doesn't affect quantum theory, then.
No.
But then you make, it's our last answer, so you mean something that introduces many world interpretations?
Well, that's not essentially my connotation. That's John Kramer's claim. And I think he has a point.
From these experiments?
Yes. And it depends on the version of many world interpretation that you're talking about. Because he says basically if you end up saying that the photon came from one of the pinholes, so you live in the world in which the photon actually went through that pinhole, and therefore it could not have interfered. But you do have evidence for interference, so you can't have many worlds. So in one world, you essentially, if you live in this world in which this thing acted as though it came from one of the pinholes, that photon could not participate in the interference. And so these worlds are separate. If they are separate, how come they interfere? Because we have evidence for interference. So I'm not sure how far we can run with that argument, but I think it seems to be a reasonable argument.
If you can translate it, usually people have many worlds when they discuss it, they have a quantum formula in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can translate it into that formula somehow, then I can see relevance, otherwise it seems...
Well, maybe somebody should do that. Yes.
I think I understand the point that Gleason might have commenced.
I'm sorry?
I think I understand the point that Gleason was reiterating what you were saying. I think I finally got it. And so I have a candidate response. So first of all, let me point out that there's sort of a similar problem in a different arena, the Elitzur-Weidman bomb testing problem. I'm not sure if you're familiar
sure.
with that. So if you are familiar with it, then I'll just state the point, which is when you have a good bomb in one of the arms, holding the mirror, and you find your detection in the dark wing, because the good bomb didn't explode, you know which path it must have taken. It couldn't have taken the path of the bomb on it. Okay? But you know that port had to have been dark if instead of being a good bomb it was a dud. But if the particle went on the left path, how could it possibly know whether there's a good bomb or a dud? So how could it know when it got the beam splitter, whether they go to the dark port or not?
It's
sort of similar. It's, how do you know whether there's a wire there or not?
It's not similar. If I may quickly tell you why it's not similar, because there the wave function at the bomb is non-zero. That is, there is a wave function present when you write it in superposition. But in this situation, you have a zero at the sort of bomb or your wire, whatever you call it. So the conceptually there is a
bomb, and you know that it's on the other path. The wave function is zero on that path. So in that sense, it's similar.
Well, so you'll have two situations. One of them is an incoherent one, which actually takes that plan up there, avoids the bump. The other one is when you have to write it in superposition. When you write it in superposition, two paths, so there is no zero. The reason you have a null labor bar is because the bump killed the main function because it exploded or got it blocked it or something, if it wasn't done. So after the bump, you would have a zero wave function, and up there you would have all of the norm would be transferred to the top one. But if this thing can be detected in terms of the superposition process, you have to use that superposition. Then you would know that there is nothing blocking it. So at the blocker, which is the bomb or the wire, in Elitzer-Wideman paradox, you have non-zero wave function. Here you actually have a zero amplitude for the field. So.
Okay. Well.
But exactly what that means.
Let's not dispute whether there's similar things going on in these two experiments or not. I'm not clear. I think there is perhaps an analogy there. But anyway, let me just play what I think could be a set of words that might satisfy you, which is that the notion that vacuum, that there's sort of nothing there and there's no substructure to the vacuum is just wrong. If you imagine a sort of invariable approach, the quantum state corresponding to the vacuum could still be a probability distribution over a number of possibilities. And so when I verify that there's a vacuum here, well, that verification could change the substructure of the vacuum. And that could have influences. So
I'm very pleased that you brought that up, because I was hoping someone at some point would pick that up and say it. And that's a very, very beautiful point, because this may actually hint at the vacuum states as to what's going on in the vacuum. And then you actually may have zero-point fields beyond the understood quantum fluctuations that we know. And in fact, the reason I did this experiment was because I had assumed such a field. I have a theory that I'm working on, and in my version of things, there is a field associated with every single particle. It's not the vacuum itself, but we can go into that later on. But interestingly, I think there is something to that there is vacuum cannot be thought just as a zero-point field that we understand in quantum mechanics. There is something else going on. Yeah, great point.
So starting to get the logic of your argument, which was sort of this, let me try that. It would really be good if you could write down the logical steps. So let's try it like this. So first of all, imagine there's no wire.
Okay.
Then you can argue, in that situation, if the lower detector clicks, the photon came from the top state and light goes. You can argue that whether both states are open or not. Okay. One can agree or disagree with that. Let's say we agree with that. Okay, so that's step one. We agree that that's true.
Why did you accept that, though?
Just for the sake of argument.
Because of conservation laws.
Just for the sake of argument.
You just accept it.
So that's step one. Okay. Now here's step two. One could probably use sort of Einsteinian type language. So if, without in any way disturbing the quantum state, if one makes a change which doesn't in any way disturb the quantum state for a particular situation, then anything you might have said without making that change is still true if you do make that change. So now we say, well, the change is introducing a wire. Now it's true, in a particular situation when both states are open, that if we introduce the wire, we don't in any way disturb the quantum state.
Minimal.
Right. So therefore, we now say, therefore, it's true that the previous conclusion I've reached, which particle state can improve, that still maintains because it hasn't disturbed the quantum state. Okay. And yet, we also have this evidence of interference. So that seems like a logical structure of your argument, which I guess is what you were saying, is just a hand comes to it.
Yes, I think that's exactly right.
And that's really nice. It's quite interesting when you get all things.
That is to say, the second part would be the tricky part.
Yeah, sure.
That if that is wrong, then why is it wrong?
Yeah, one can argue about that, but there are other situations where you might think that the quantum state itself is the entire reality. This Albert come for recently. But it's an interesting. One can just accept those steps and then say those are the assumptions going into the argument, and then you certainly do seem to see both evidence for quantum interference and yet at the same time have this switch main information.
Yes. And if I quickly just maybe this would interest you as well in terms of the information theory, is if you separate, you sort of do this in separate steps. That is to say, you don't say I have just one observer knowing about the whole setup. I have a couple of observers knowing parts of the setup. What does it mean and how it works? So just the contextual low measurement stuff. Say this is the wire and this is connected to observer A, and somebody down here is looking at the whatever happens downstream. This is the interference plane, this is immediately after the interference plane, so we don't have a list. So you know that you would expect an interference pattern to build up there, right? Now this observer A only reads out what this detector tells him. Doesn't know about what's going on the other side. Now, the context is this. If he doesn't know about what B says or what B observes, he cannot make a statement about the state of the wave function. He can't say anything. He could basically it would be equivalent to say, hey, the laser is off. I don't know, it's on or off, I don't see anything. But if B just gives him one piece of information, says, you know what, I only observe 10,000 photons. Once he says that, he immediately can conjecture exactly what's going on for the wave function. And all of a sudden, the context of this negative or no measurement, which is not a measurement in the quantum sense, becomes a real measurement within the classical sense. And so there's sort of a trade-off, depending on the amount of information that's provided to him, you can even predict exactly how the photons are distributed on these planes without actually seeing it. So that's something I just wanted to throw in. And sorry. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to point out that there's a simpler version of your experiment, which I think maybe would clarify some of these issues, because it doesn't involve lenses and so a lot of the.
Very simple versions of this, but go ahead.
It's a Mach center. Imagine a Mach center parameter. And imagine that you set the path length such that if you feed the particle into the upper port, it comes out the upper port. And if you feed it.
Are you talking about Orwell's setup? Bill Orwell's setup?
Who set up?
Bill Orwell?
I don't know. It's very standard. So the Mach Zehnder is just a beam splitter, two mirrors, and another beam splitter. So I've got it set up so that if you feed it in the top port, it comes out the top port. Feed it in the bottom port, it comes out the bottom port.
Yeah.
Yeah, the simple Mach Zehnder, exactly. And now imagine instead of putting it in either the left or the right, you put in a coherent superposition of left and right. Well, then it definitely goes to the right-hand path because it destructively interferes on the left-hand path. And then I get 50-50 statistics. Yeah. Now, if I put a brick on the right-hand path, well, it doesn't change anything. That's like your wire. It didn't go through the right-hand path, so I can put a brick there and it won't change the outcome of the experiment. And now, using Leeson's terminology, you can claim that because in the case where I start with a coherent superposition of left, you know, coming into this input port and this input port, putting the brick there doesn't change the quantum state. Then, if that doesn't change, you know, the actual state of affairs, my original inference, from finding it here, it being here, and finding it here, it being here, should also go through. Therefore, I have, you know, both interference and.
So he's kind of related to the Elixir diamond bomb because it's probably not saying.
I think that's why I was. You
know, well, yes and no.
But this version is seems to be related to that.
Right. I actually had a sort of a lengthy argument with Bill on this. It's exactly the same thing. And here's our number of problems with that argument. One, the Mach Zehnder interferometer is not exactly the same as your double slit interferometer. There's a different process going on. We can talk about this. This is going to take us probably an hour to discuss. But there's a difference in terms of the actual process of the superposition in the Mach Zehnder and in the double slit experiment. In the Mach Zehnder, what you have is that if you collapse the apparatus, the Mach-Zehnder apparatus, what you end up with is essentially something like this. Really, what is going on is you have a source, and you have these mirrors. Forget the mirrors. Mirrors don't do much. The splitters do something special. And what they do is they produce sort of different images of the source, which farther downstream overlap. So one of them produces this, the other one produces this image. So these end up interfering. Okay? And so usually the way you do it, so this interference takes place because of these virtual sources that are produced because of those beam splitters on the path. So the problematic part of Mach-Zehnder interferometers is, if you want to set it up the way you're suggesting, is the distance between the two virtual sources should be of the order of lambda. Okay. In an optical system, so exactly when you have a situation like this, what happens is you see those interference patterns up there, the circular rings? So they're sort of complementary. But what happens if the difference in the distance is of the order of lambda, only one of the outputs has all the flux. The other one is completely zero. So that's sort of all or none we use. And, you know, that's what it's good for. But having done that, you essentially, within optics, whenever you have differences of the order of lambda, they cannot be resolved. So you cannot use a Vitrean information in that sense that they're linked to a particular slit. You may talk about these paths, but these paths aren't the real question. The question that we ask in our experiment is not which path it took. It is which slit it took. That is to say, which secondary source did it originate from? It's a different question. It's a different thing. So essentially, in this setup, you have a built-in impossibility of obtaining the train information of the same type that we use in this experiment. So it's not equivalent. The other thing is, again, when you block the path, you're blocking the entire path when you place that thing. Here, the blockage is not taking place 100%. It's only taking place where the dark fringes are.
You're not blocking both paths. The dark fringe in this case is...
It's just one of them that it turns out to be. So it's basically, it's essentially like saying, that's exactly equivalent to saying, in this experiment, not the Cabernet equivalent exactly, to just picking a bright fringe and a dark fringe. Right? Just the bright fringe. The bright fringe is where it goes.
I can put bricks everywhere except these two paths.
No, those everywhere is the path where there is a structure, the structural interference.
The point is that you could do your experiment where you put a wall in front of everything except one bright fringe and one dark fringe, and then it becomes just like the Mach-Zehnder interferometer.
There you go, because it doesn't. Because when you do that, no, I'll explain to you exactly why. Because when you do that, you have blocked the wave function to produce sufficient resolution. What happens is then you sort of limit the thing. What you end up having is the images get washed out completely. So yeah, you're right. It is equivalent in that sense, but you have a built-in destruction of the train information by that process, in which you end up having completely washed out images, so you can't even talk about the train information anymore.
Okay, so I agree that they're not equivalent, but I think all the differences are not relevant to the conclusion you're trying to make.
I think it's there, absolutely.
No, I think this Mach-Zehnder experiment makes it can be...
Wait a second, you just destroyed the Vitrean information in my experiment, and you're telling me they're not relevant? If you destroy the Vitrean information with an equivalent analogy, then there is no equivalency. Because I need to have Vitrean information.
The two fringes here, I agree, will wash out stuff. But in the Mach-Zehnder...
But stuff is Vitrean information.
Things will not be washed out.
Oh, they won't be. There is no rich information.
There
is a rich path. There is a rich path question rather than rich origin or rich slit.
But we
can talk about that. It's not the same question.
I think it is.
Okay, that's your opinion. And we should talk about this. I think we should really spend time to delineate exactly what is what I mean.
I think I agree properly. Maybe we can go through this in detail.
Absolutely. I think that's a good idea. Yeah. But, I mean, we have to be careful about what we mean. I mean, in terms of, everybody thinks that the Mach center is equivalent to which way interference is interference and so forth. It's not true. You can't have a setup like this, in the Mach center setup, which becomes equivalent to mine in the following way. Think that you've produced a large separation between the virtual sources, many orders, many times lambda, right? What happens is you have an interference pattern like those two that you see. Now you can, if now, replace a bunch of sort of circular wires at the outputs, which fall exactly at the minimum of that interference or the other one, and then you place a lens in front of it, then you would have two images, one, and they would fall one in front of the other. So it would be one for one source, the other one for the other source.
Okay, so I suspect that you're thinking of a different experiment to the one that Robert's going to get.
If we're making different analogies.
So I think that Robert's going to get to a different idea than one Robert.
Maybe,
so
okay. Maybe absolutely, let's do that.
Maybe we should stop now.
Thanks so much.